All rise. The Honorable Chief Justice and Justices of the Supreme Court of Ohio. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio is now in open session pursuant to adjournment.
You may be seated. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case is 2019-373, Jeffrey P. Sherman versus the Ohio Public Employees Retirement System. For the appellant, Mr. Peterson.
Thank you, Your Honor. Chief Justice O'Connor, and may it please the court, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes of time for rebuttal. When a retiree takes a new job, they are less likely than unemployed retirees to need additional financial assistance. That is why when OPERS began providing a small additional health care subsidy to many of its retirees, it chose not to provide that subsidy to those that it could most easily identify as reemployed, retirees who took an OPERS covered position. This distinction was rational for at least two reasons. First, because of administrative convenience, and second, because of administrative cost imposed by these reemployed retirees. But before I address either of those substantive reasons, I'd like to take a step back and discuss the rational basis standard, because that is the standard that all parties agree applies here, and it is a standard that the 10th District simply got wrong. The 10th District had held that OPERS did not provide enough information to trigger Mr. Sherman's burden under the rational basis standard. And to be sure, it discussed this court's precedent, but that holding simply gets rational basis review wrong. Under rational basis review, the question is, as this court knows, whether there's any reasonably conceivable state of facts that could provide a rational basis for a challenged classification. And the burden is always on the party attacking the classification to negative every conceivable basis which might support it. The state has no corresponding burden to produce any evidence to sustain the rationality of a challenged classification. And this court and American Association of University Professors made very clear that there is no evidence that is required to sustain a government practice against a rational basis challenge. And Mr. Sherman simply could not carry his burden below, and he cannot carry it here now. And so turning to the equal protection analysis, there's two relevant questions. First, is there a valid state interest? And second, has the state gone about advancing that interest in a rational manner?
Is it the position of the state of Ohio that the phrase, "no state shall deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws," in the phrase, "all political power is inherent in the people, government is instituted for their equal protection and benefit," mean the same thing?
Your Honor, I don't think is originally understood that the Ohio Constitution, Article 1, Section 2, meant the same thing as the equal protection clause in the 14th Amendment, but this court has long interpreted them to be the same.
Is it the state's position that they mean the same thing?
Your position is that under an originalist understanding, they do not mean the same thing, but as this court's precedent has held, long settled precedent going back to the 1800s, and so we think that at this point that's largely stare decisis, and we're not arguing today that the court should disturb its precedent. We think that what this court has held going back to the 1800s and what the U.S. Supreme Court has held is simply a reflection of the long understanding that equal people should be treated alike, and at the same time, it is difficult to make laws, to legislate, if every classification between individuals is subject to scrutiny. And so,
in the state constitution, the phrase equal protection and benefit, does the word equal modify only protection or also benefit?
Your Honor, I think that it does modify the equal protection applies to both in that
the phrase. Word equal applies to both?
I honestly, Your Honor.
And so isn't the subsidy not equal? Isn't it a benefit?
Well, Your Honor, two things. If you talk about the original understanding, because that's
I'm just reading the words.
Yeah, yes, Your Honor. If you look to that section, though, it speaks of all political power being inherent in the people, mm-hmm. and that government is instituted for their equal protection and benefit. And I think that phrase modifies the first sentence. And so if you're talking about what equal protection modifies, then it really modifies that first sentence. And so if you Article 1, Section 2, we think, as originally understood, modified, it talks about government being established. But I think there's a larger point to be
made.
Well,
then shouldn't, if that's true, if government is instituted for their equal protection and benefit, isn't that a higher standard than no state shall deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of a state statute? That sounds like a higher standard.
Well, Your Honor, I would disagree for two reasons. One, I don't think that that matches the original understanding of what that clause meant. But more importantly, that is not a standard that Mr. Sherman has argued for here. In fact, if you look in his briefs, there's no discussion of the history of Article 1, Section 2. There's, in fact, you may struggle to even find a citation specifically to Article 1, Section 2. And so even if the court were inclined to hold that the Equal Protection Clause that the court has identified in the Ohio Constitution could provide greater protection, it would have to both overturn its precedent and it would have to make an argument that Mr. Sherman has not made here. Because at that point, the court...
Well, the proposition of law talks about Ohio's Equal Protection Clause, so that's what I'm looking at.
Yes, Your Honor. And we made an argument in our brief that the Equal Protection Clause, as originally understood, did not apply in the way that the court has applied it since the 1800s, but we have pointed out that the larger principle, and I think this maybe goes to your question about whether there should be a higher standard, the larger principle is this, that people need to be treated alike. And at the same time, that if government is to function, you need to be able to draw distinctions between people.
Okay, as the court said, Counselor, if OPERS decided that all retirees whose last names begin with from A to M would get the subsidy and N through Z would get less, would that pass constitutional muster? Is that fine?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, because that would be arbitrary. And the distinction here is not arbitrary for the two reasons I identified at the beginning, convenience and cost.
When you say convenience and cost, wouldn't it save OPERS more money if all retired employees got the same smaller amount of the subsidy?
Well, Your Honor, it doesn't have to be a perfect distinction. And that's what this court said in Pickaway County Skilled Gaming, is that even if there's a rough accommodation, even if there might be a better way of going about things, even if you may be able to further advance your interest, it doesn't have to be perfect. But
it has to be lawful. I mean, so it's you're saying this is just one way of doing it, but you have a class of people who are not treated the same as another class, similarly situated, retirees. So I guess what's the rational basis for saying it is easier to discern and less money because these people are in our system? Well, Your Honor, can simply ask a question of a retiree. Are you employed?
Your Honor, your suggestion and Mr. Sherman's alternatives all require things of OPERS that it's not required to do now. Right now, when someone goes back to work for OPERS, OPERS learns immediately and automatically that they have returned to work. And there's an official way and an unofficial way. And I think the unofficial way really goes to your point. Because all of a sudden, that retiree and its new his or her new employer starts making payments to OPERS. So without asking any question, without sending any form, without accounting or managing, without verifying or enforcing, OPERS knows that individual is working again.
But doesn't that mean that because the person is reemployed by the state, it actually saves them money?
No, Your Honor, because there's actually an additional cost that comes with a retiree going back to work.
Well, are those costs the same, though, where you have a part-time employee, like you do here, that wouldn't be able to get the same benefits that a full-time employee would have?
No, Your Honor, the costs are different. What we're not talking about is costs in terms of money paid out by the state. We're talking costs to OPERS as a system, because OPERS must maintain two different systems to track and account for benefits. Because under Revised Code 145.33, that sets out the benefit that most people earn. But people who are retired and go back to work for OPERS earn a separate benefit that must be accounted for separately. And that's set out in Revised Code 145.384B2. And under that, there is a separate benefit. They pay into a separate pot of money, which requires OPERS to maintain a separate system, account for them separately. And so these are costs to the system. So the cost that's imposed isn't a cost of paying out a pension or paying out a salary. It is administrative costs that OPERS must shoulder because these retirees have gone back to work.
Because you've got that, what seems like an evidentiary record, I think I know your response to that. Is it appropriate, though, on a motion to dismiss? I mean, all of those kinds of issues sound to me like evidentiary issues that would be more appropriate at summary judgment.
I think motion to dismiss is appropriate for both a legal reason and for a practical reason. The legal reason is that we don't bear the burden. The burden is on the party attacking the challenge. And even in their complaint, if you look at paragraph 7, 8, and 9, they identify the interest that OPERS asserted, and then their alternative involves additional administrative effort that the US Supreme Court, at least, says sufficient to justify a rational basis under Armour v. City of Indianapolis.
Counsel, but is also that burden measurable? Has it been calculated?
Your Honor, we have not introduced any evidence of what that burden is, so the cost of that is not in the record.
Because so we don't know whether OPERS has to hire more people, they have to bring in some software guru and refigure their programs on how they allocate, and how they keep track of all this. We don't know what that burden is. You're just saying, logically, there's got to be more work associated with this.
Well, Your Honor, it is outside the record, but I can confirm that OPERS does have additional administrative burdens, additional staff to manage, for example, the separate benefit. And so, yes, it is.
So would you do away with that entire separate benefit category?
No, Your Honor, statutorily, OPERS is required to provide the separate benefit, and it does impose costs. But Justice French, I promised you that I would give you another reason why a motion to dismiss is appropriate, and for the very reason that rational basis exists. Because the whole point, as the court said in 1908, is that in Weber v. Felton, that simply invalidating law because everyone gets a different benefit would make legislation impossible and would be as wise as trying to shut off the gentle rain from heaven because every man does not get the same quantity of water. And so this reflects a principle that the legislature must be able to draw distinctions without having to go into court and present evidence and defend every classification between different types of people.
But, and so, well, one of the additional bases, though, was that I think the majority was discussing was, yes, you have the statutory basis for these separate accounting, basically, but there's no overriding policy within the state of Ohio that says you can't do this, a policy against double dipping. So how do you think that figures into the analysis on a motion to dismiss?
Your Honor, two reasons. One, if a policy like that was permissible, then there would be that concedes that there's a rational basis to distinguish between the parties. Because if you can have a statewide policy, that means that there's a rational basis for distinguishing between reemployed and not reemployed in the private and public sectors. But more importantly, there's no reason that policy has to be a statewide policy. Why, if it's permissible for the General Assembly to do, then OPERS certainly can do it as a matter of its own administration of its fund, particularly when there are additional administrative costs associated with identifying individuals that are reemployed.
But how do we know the costs? I get we've got the statutory basis, but you've referred to costs a number of times. Do we have that on a motion to dismiss? Do we have that in what we have to look at this point? Again, we're back to the summary judgment issue.
Your Honor, if I could answer your question and then reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal, you don't need that evidence because that's the heart of this court's decision in an American Association of University Professors, is that there is no evidence that is required under rational basis. The court specifically said that. It rejected a heightened evidentiary standard. And so having asserted an interest here in ease of identification, everything that Mr. Sherman posits, we all agree would require at least some additional steps. That is enough to satisfy rational basis, and you don't need evidence of how weighty that is, because under American Association of University Professors and under Armour v. City of Indianapolis, those types of convenience and administrative burdens are a sufficient rational basis.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Fiorelli?
Yes, good morning. Madam Chief Justice, and may it please the court. My name is Nicole Fiorelli, and I, along with my partner, Patrick Parati of Dworkin and Bernstein, represent Jeffrey Sherman in this case. Your Honors, we're asking that this court affirm the 10th District Court of Appeals decision to reverse the trial court's grant of the motion to dismiss and allow my client's equal protection claim to proceed. We ask this court to affirm because there are no reasonably conceivable set of facts to provide for the disparate treatment that that OPR's engaged in. I want to start with the most startling example of why there's an equal protection violation here. You have two individuals who both worked for an OPR's covered employer. Both are able to retire, both worked long enough to get a pension, both worked long enough to get health insurance through OPRs. Both of them retire, they're getting their pension, they decide we want to go back to work. One individual goes back to work for an OPRs covered employer. One individual goes back to work for, say, an employer covered by the state teacher retirement system. OPRs knows that both of those individuals have gone back to work, yet OPRs only refuses to pay the $74 monthly subsidy to the individual who goes back to work for OPRs. That's completely arbitrary. Yes, it saves money, but it's arbitrary, and under this court's precedent, if you have only an arbitrary reason for saving money, that is not a rational basis.
Would your client be okay if the state of Ohio just said no one gets the $74?
If no one gets the $74, there would not be an equal protection violation.
Thank you.
In this case, you're saying so because the state teachers' employment is another state retirement system that OPRs will know if someone is in that system, those people should be brought in too.
That's exactly right, Your Honor. So as OPRs admitted in their brief, the pension plans for those other state employers notify OPRs when there's a reemployment of one of their retirees.
So if they simply broaden their scope then to include those and any other state employment plans that notifies OPRs, then is the equal protection issue gone?
We don't believe so because there's a third group of people, and that's the individuals who retire and then go back to work for the private sector. And we do not believe that there is an administrative burden with respect to identifying those people, and we specifically pled against that in our complaint.
But do they have to do that?
I would think for an equal protection, there would still be an equal protection violation in that case.
Why?
Because there is no difference between someone who goes back to work for OPRs or STRS or Walmart, because those people can be identified in a non-burdensome manner. So we believe that there wouldn't be a rational basis to justify treating, on one hand, the people who go to work back to work for a STRS-covered employer or an OPRs-covered employer different than those who go back to work for a private employer.
What about Mr. Peterson's argument that there is additional cost with those who return to OPRs employment?
So that is the cost they're raising with respect to the cost of managing this annuity, which, by the way, was not mentioned in the Court of Appeals below. They were not raising this issue of the administrative cost of the annuity. But notwithstanding that, there is 2 points on that. First, the annuity cost has nothing to do with the health insurance cost. So essentially they're saying, well, plaintiff costs us more for this basket A, so therefore we're going to take it out of basket B. We haven't come across and they haven't cited a case where because an individual costs you more in some completely unrelated facet, you're allowed to penalize them for the facet that's at issue.
Well, why is it completely unrelated if it's still coming out of the state fund?
It's, I, I think there's actually, there's a pension fund, and then there's the issue with the health insurance money. I'm not sure what comes out of what, Your Honor, but in all of the cases that they've cited, for example, they cite two cases that dealt with administrative cost. They cited McCrone versus Bank One Corp, which is one of this court's cases from 1995, and then they cited Armour versus the City of Indianapolis, which is a U.S. Supreme Court case. And both those cases were about administrative burden or saving money, and they were directly related to the issue at hand. We haven't seen a case where a completely unrelated issue is allowed to serve as a rational basis for the saving costs measure.
But what you're calling completely unrelated would still be funds within OPIR's responsibility.
It would, Your Honor. The other point to make is that there's no, I mean, Your Honor had mentioned the issue of summary judgment and the fact that this is a motion to dismiss. There is nothing inherently on its face to suggest that managing this administrative component of providing a reemployed retiree from an OPIR's employer their annuity is going to cost more than whatever OPIRs would have to manage for whoever fills that position. Whoever fills that position, whether it's Mr. Sherman, someone who worked for OPIRs in the past, or someone brand new to the government's going to have to track that person. They don't have someone come in brand new and just not put them in their system. There's costs associated with that. There is nothing on its face to suggest that the cost of managing Mr. Sherman's annuity, someone who's already in their system, is going to be anything beyond nominal, if anything at all, over someone who comes in who might take that position fresh.
But I assume what the only thing you have to argue right now is we don't know what that evidence is.
That's correct, Your Honor. And I think that that's why the Court of Appeals was correct in its decision saying, look, we understand that OPIRS is arguing this administrative burden component, although they didn't argue it for the annuity. They argued it for the identification issue. But we don't have enough information to decide, yes, this is rational or no, it's not. And the Court of Appeals, I think, was correct in saying, we're not saying that OPIRS cannot show this or that there's not evidence to support a rational basis, but we just don't have enough information right now, and therefore it's not appropriate to resolve this matter on 12b-6, but instead let's go back down, let's see what the evidence shows. And actually, in the case that they rely on, the Armour versus City of Indianapolis, where there was an administrative burden argument that was made, that was on summary judgment. And the court there specifically noted that under that record, the petitioners hadn't shown that the administrative concerns were too insubstantial. And the court in that case actually analyzed the numbers. We don't have anything. And like I said, there's nothing on the face of their argument saying, you know, well, maybe the administrative, managing the administrative components of the annuities may cost more. That's completely speculative. There's no rational reason for that. So we don't believe that that supplies a reason for rational basis. The other thing, while they're not articulating it as a rational basis reason, opposing counsel pointed out at the beginning of the argument, he said, well, someone who goes, it's rational what we're doing because someone who goes back to work needs the subsidy less than someone who doesn't. That's false for two reasons. One, just because somebody goes back to work doesn't mean they're in less of financial need than someone who doesn't go back to work. It depends on a whole host of factors, including what your pension is, what your personal situation is, whether your reemployment may be part-time or full-time.
Whether you're driving your spouse crazy.
Exactly.
By being home, so many different things, right?
Right. So there's a whole variety of things that could come up. So to say that as a blanket principle that someone needs the money less because they go back to work is completely unfounded.
But isn't that what the government does all the time when it legislates, is it draws these very broad lines that's are under-inclusive and over-inclusive, and we say that's fine if it's rational basis review.
Sure, Your Honor. And I think, though, in this situation, it's just, it's wholly without merit. And additionally, the second problem with their argument is that they're not drawing a line between someone who goes back to work and someone who doesn't go back to work, because some of the people who go back to work do get the subsidy. So there's no, and there's no indication that, well, if you go back to work for an OPRS-covered employer, you're going to need that less than if you go back to work for a private employer.
So would it be okay if the government had said any public employer doesn't get the subsidy? Would that change things?
No, Your Honor, because as I mentioned with Justice Stewart's question, similar question, I think before, we don't think that there's administrative burden associated with the people who go back to work for the private employer. So we think there would still be an equal protection violation, except the class of plaintiffs would change. Instead of it just being people who went back to work for an OPRS-covered employer, it would be people who went back to work for a public employer. We think there would still be an equal protection violation. But as the facts of this case, when you just simply compare people who go back to work for OPRS and people who go back to work for, say, STRS, there absolutely is an equal protection violation because they don't have any sort of administrative burden, we can't find these people type argument to apply to that situation.
But that sounds like a merits response. You know, I think what Mr. Peterson was saying is, look, we have the statutory requirement that we have to keep track of people in different ways depending on where they're employed. And so why wouldn't we just look at that, as the state suggests, and say there's an obvious burden to that, and we get to decide whether how high that burden is.
Are you referring to the annuities? Are there annuities argument,
Your Honor? I'll just tell you, to be honest, I look at this and think, well, I don't know a lot about the OPRS system, but obviously there are different levels of costs that apply to somebody who's going back to work, whether no matter where they're employed, and that there are these different rules for people who are going back to work. So whether it's an annuity, whether it's the association, you know, cost associated with accounting for them differently, there just seem to be costs.
Sure, and as there would be costs if someone else filled the position. So we don't think that there's anything on its face that suggests that one, the OPRS folks would cost more than the non-OPRS folks.
Mr. Peterson relied on the university professor's case. Do you have a response to that, why you think that does not appropriate precedent?
That case just says that there's no requirement that the state produce evidence. And I think
that seems like a big
principle. Sure, but at the same time, that we don't think that goes so far to say whatever the state says, no matter how head-scratching it may appear, that we just have to accept that and use that as our rational basis. For example, I would point to this court's opinion in State Ex Rel Dorsum versus the Industrial Commission. In that situation, the state made two arguments for rational basis. They said, while our goal is to provide dependents of deceased workers the opportunity to be eligible for this maximum statutory amount, it was a workers' comp situation, and they picked a year, I think it was 1976, and they said, everyone before 1976, you get, I think it was 2/3 of the weekly average benefit, and everyone after that year, you get 100%. And their stated goal was, well, we want to help these dependents of the deceased workers. Now, on its face, okay, they want to help these people get more benefits. Well, why are you picking this year? Don't the people before 1976 need the money just as much as the people after? And the court questioned that. And I think that the court has the right and should be questioning things as well. So to say, when you're going to have costs, no matter who fills that position, I think it's quite reasonable to say, well, why is one more expensive than the other? And they haven't even really argued that or set forth why that is. And I think that's why the Court of Appeals was correct to say, based on what we have in front of us on this motion to dismiss and the briefing, we just don't have enough information to say, plaintiff, you're not allowed to proceed forward, you don't have an equal protection claim. Let's flesh this out, because we are not satisfied that there is rational basis for this disparate treatment.
Counsel, how many people are affected like your client? Do you have an idea?
It's not in the record, but I believe from discovery there was about 4,600 people at one point in time. That obviously is subject to change because each month people may decide to go back to work or they may decide to, you know, quit their reemployment. But at one point in time, it was about 4,600 people.
That were rehires with OPERS system.
Correct. Yes. If your honors don't have any other questions, I thank you for your time, and we respectfully request that you affirm the 10th District Court of Appeals. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Peterson, were you aware that the number is about 4,600 people that this affects?
We're not aware of that, Your Honor.
Does that change your perspective on the burden?
No, Your Honor, because the larger principle remains the same, both as to the burden and as to the...
So would 100 people still represent a burden, and that would be you'd be here arguing about that?
Your Honor, there would still be an administrative burden associated with identifying those individuals, and there would still be a cost associated. But I think the larger point is a rational basis point broadly.
What's the rational basis for not including at least the other public pensions?
There's two reasons, Your Honor. One, the costs, as we already discussed, are different. OPERS doesn't bear costs on the back end when those individuals are reemployed, and the ability to identify them are different. They lack the informal notification that comes when those employees...
But you have notification, I mean, right?
Your Honor, that notification is also different. An OPERS employer must inform OPERS that they've reemployed a retiree, whereas the notification requirement for the other systems is both requires the employer to notify their system, that system to notify OPERS, and there's also an enforcement mechanism.
I guess I don't understand why that's different. If someone tells you something, does it really matter who tells you?
Well, Your Honor, there's also an enforcement mechanism. So in addition to the additional costs these individuals impose, they're missing an enforcement mechanism, which is that under OPERS, they can go after the employer for any improperly paid benefits if they don't provide that notification. And that enforcement mechanism is missing for these other systems.
Why couldn't that be changed just by legislation or rule?
Your Honor, certainly it could, but it is not required under the Equal
Protection
Clause.
But that would take care of the problem, right?
It still would be missing that informal notification. And that's really what matters.
It would be missing an informal notification?
Yeah, the informal notification that comes when a newly reemployed OPERS retiree makes payments. This is a universal. It doesn't require on anyone to fill out a form to notify OPERS, be it a other system or an individual. OPERS gets automatic notification.
But
and
again,
the only way...
But isn't notification notification? You know, if I tell you it's raining outside or one of the other justices tells you it's raining, does it matter who told you?
No, it doesn't. But the costs are still different. If it cost me more if you told me versus one of the other justices, then that would still provide a rational basis. And that's a point I would like to make about the larger rational basis. Because this case, if the court affirms, is not just affirming for 4,600 people $74 a month. Because what it will be doing is it will be opening the floodgates to every case requiring evidence.
If we affirm, doesn't it go back to the trial court?
But as a larger principle, Your Honor, you'd be affirming that evidence is required and that this is not appropriate for motion to dismiss. And so let's say someone wants to challenge equal protection for a driver's license at 16 versus 16 and a half. Does that require evidence now? Is it open to discovery? And I think some of the...
I'm presuming the cost is not your basis for not allowing somebody in a situation with a driver's license. I mean, that's a totally different policy issue.
It's a totally different policy issue, Your Honor, but if it is required to have evidence, if you cannot move to dismiss, if you must introduce evidence, one, it would go against American Association of University Professors, but two, it opens the door to discovery. And I think some of the points that my friends on the other side have made today about, well, some people may need it more than others, depending on where they work. These are the type of evidentiary questions that rational basis simply does not deal with. Justice French, you noted that there are certain gut reaction, instinctive response, and that's what rational basis review is about. It is about the state being able to offer any rational basis. And the court, in fact, has the ability to identify its own rational basis, even ones beyond the ones the state identified.
So you've used your time.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. We'll take the matter under advisement. You'll be notified of our decision.